played many monsters over the years. This is my sixth movie with Guillermo, and I played creatures in all of them, multiple ones. So I've done 12 creatures for him now. Never have I had carried this kind of a love story that is all consummated all the way, you know?
No, I don't really know. But anyway, we're going to hear all about interspecies romance in a little bit. The man who plays the monster in Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water came by, along with this film's cinematographer. We'll have that coming up. But first, there is new hope military tensions between North and South Korea could be thawing. The two countries today reopened a direct line of communication along the demilitarized zone in preparation for possible high-level talks next week. It follows a New Year's Day speech from North Korean President Kim Jong-un, in which he made a rare overture for new negotiations with the South. But Kim also re-upped his threats against the United States in that speech. He said he had a nuclear button ready to launch an attack on any American target. And not to be left out, President Donald Trump tweeted last night that he, too, has a nuclear button, one that is much bigger and more powerful. Here to help us make sense of all of this is David Kong. He's director of the Korean Studies Institute at USC. Welcome.
Thanks.
Well, first, how sincere do you think these overtures from North Korea to South Korea are?
I think they're quite sincere in the sense that I think Kim Jong-un was ready to take a step back from a lot of the tensions over the last year, and he chose his own time to do it, which was the New Year's Day speech that he made, and they opened up the hotline right away with South Korea. So I think they're at least willing to explore what can happen.
This is a hotline that's been closed for a couple of years.
Yes.
And what happens? What is the significance of this hotline?
Well, the significance is that in 2015, the North cut the hotline, and the only way to communicate was either literally shouting across the DMZ with a megaphone, or as happened yesterday with the South Korean unification minister on South Korean TV saying, let's talk. And then on North Korean TV, their counterpart said, okay, let's do it. So the hotline is truly a hotline to allow them to actually communicate face-to-face.
Okay.
Or not face-to-face,
yeah,
but voice-to-voice.
In real
time. Yeah.
So what about this threat that the North could attack any target in the United States? How credible is that?
Well, it's increasingly credible in the sense that that's why they test their missiles, and that's why they've tested over the last year. So it's not quite clear that they actually could hit anything in the United States. But they're certainly better than they were before. But the larger point is that North Korea is saying continually, we will fight back if we're attacked. And so this is just part of the normal type of deterrence rhetoric that North Korea continually says.
I guess just as an American and as a Californian, how seriously should we take this? How scared should we be that a nuclear missile can come to us?
0% scared that North Korea is going to attack first. There's no possible way North Korea is going to start a war with the United States. So as long as we don't attack them first, they won't attack us. Deterrence has worked for 65 years now, and it will continue to work because the costs for both sides are very high. One of the reasons that you shouldn't be worried is both sides continually remind each other that the other side is back. So that's with Trump's response and Kim Jong-un. They're basically, I mean, it's a little flamboyant, but they're basically saying the same things presidents have said for decades, which is, we will fight back.
All right. So where do the Olympics play in all of this? They're coming up next month in the South Korean city of Pyeongchang, and the North maybe wants in on the Olympics?
Yeah. And in some ways, I think this is a ideal way to lower the temperature in the room a little bit, which is, the North came out. I mean, Kim Jong-un's speech, his New Year's Day speech, was masterful. I mean, it was really surprising. It took everybody by surprise. He even said, good luck to the South, which made everyone breathe a little bit of a sigh of relief that the North wasn't going to try and disrupt it. If they actually do send some type of a team to the Olympics, whatever that would entail, there's even some more chance that the North and the South could at least begin to talk about ways that they could reduce the temperature a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, so it's fairly significant.
Yeah, and I guess they don't want to be worried that the North would disrupt the Olympics in any way, militarily or in any other way.
Sure, like with a missile test or something like that. I mean, what it seems to be signaling is that North Korea doesn't plan to do anything who knows what will happen in 2 months, but it essentially doesn't plan to be doing anything to disrupt it. And this is one reason that sports events like this, like in the past, the Olympics, were opportunities for the South and the North to do some a little bit of cooperation and send some joint teams or at least march into the stadiums together was a way to find some way to cooperate and to not only just be calling each other names.
Mm. So stepping back a little bit from all of this, do you see any substantive and bigger changes happening in terms of the relationship between the North and the South? You have the reopening of the hotline, of course, and some, you know, Olympic overtures. But aside from that, do you see anything else shifting?
Not yet. And so we don't want to get too carried away with, you know, with thinking that this is all wonderful, and we don't want to be too optimistic. On the other hand, relations between North Korea and the outside world tend to follow a cycle where we go up in tensions and both sides call each other names and threaten to attack each other. And then we find a way out and we find a way, a sort of off-ramp or way to lower the tensions. And so in that sense, I would say we are in that part of a cycle where I think everyone's trying to find a way to step back a little bit.
Hmm. And how is this all affecting the relationship between the United States and South Korea? The president of South Korea, critical of Donald Trump's rhetoric, but how is that affecting their diplomatic relations?
You know, the U.S. has traditionally supported South Korean attempts to cooperate with the North, to have better relations with the North. And, you know, tradition, we've always said, if South Korea can find a way to engage North Korea, that's fine. You know, the worry is always that North Korea is trying to drive a wedge between the U.S. and South Korea and trying to decouple the alliance. You know, in this case, given where we are in terms of the concerns about conflict, my sense is that this is exploring whether the North is sincere about any of these overtures is actually in everybody's interest to at least push forward and see what might happen. So I don't think the U.S.-Korea-South Korea alliance is in any threat.
Are you worried, though, that the United States might launch a nuclear attack?
No, and for the same reason that I'm not worried about North Korea. The U.S., I mean, talk about our willingness to fight back is one thing, and presidents from Obama to Bush to Clinton have all said, all options are on the table. We will fight back if you attack first. To actually start a war, and I can't imagine the U.S. would start with a nuclear attack, but even to launch some missiles at North Korea, sort of a bloody the nose, is to take enormous risks and hope that the North doesn't fight back. So deterrence works both ways. The costs and the risks to the United States of even a preventive or even a small surgical strike, the costs and the risks are so high that's done only under exceedingly rare circumstances. So I don't think the U.S. is going to risk it.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Anytime.
That's David Kong. He is director of the Korean Studies Institute at USC. Well, the president's tweet about North Korea and nuclear button size came just a few hours before excerpts from a dishy new book were published. Fire and Fury offers a look inside the Trump White House and all the drama that entails. It's getting tons of buzz, particularly for the salty quotes from former chief strategist Steve Bannon, who accuses Jared Kushner, Donald Trump Jr., and Paul Manafort of, quote, treasonous behavior when they met with Russians during the campaign. The book comes out next week. Meanwhile, remember the so-called Steele dossier that purported to lay out Trump's ties to Russia? Well, the guys behind that are speaking out now. Joining us now to discuss all of this is Jonathan Weissman, deputy Washington editor for The New York Times. Welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so first let's talk about this book by Michael Wolff, Fire and Fury, and this quote from Steve Bannon getting tons of press, the treasonous quote, and then Donald Trump's response that Bannon has lost his mind. What is your reaction with this back and forth?
Well, you know, obviously Steve Bannon very clearly is Michael Wolff's biggest source. So much of this book, at least what we have been able to read so far, a very large amount is excerpted in the New York Magazine right now. So much of this book seems to be from Bannon's perspective. It makes Bannon out to be the center of everything. It makes him the responsible for all the good that happened to Trump, and not responsible for any of the bad. And Donald Trump obviously is incredibly miffed about this. I mean, what we've seen so far is a statement released from the President of the United States and far too long to be tweeted, followed by a statement from Sarah Huckabee Sanders, his press secretary, and the press secretary for Melania, denouncing the book. Obviously, Michael Wolff and Steve Bannon have gotten under the president's skin here. Mm.
Yeah, Melania's press secretary weighed in because apparently, according to Michael Wolff, she was in tears on election night. Nobody expected to win, and she didn't want that.
Yeah, that opening scene where they're all sitting and they've all assured everyone that, no, don't worry, we're not going to win, but we're going to become famous. We're going to be the biggest things in the world. Donald is going to open up his TV network, and Melania will go back to what Michael Wolff said was discreet lunching. And then suddenly they are President of the United States and First Lady of the United States. And as Michael Wolff describes this scene on election night, Melania is in tears. President-elect Trump is at first nonplussed, confused, and then by the end of the night convinced that he indeed could and should be President of the United States, and off to the races we are.
Yeah, but he does describe a White House that has been described elsewhere as a chaotic place where Steve Bannon was trying to control everything and nobody really knew where they stood, and the president was kind of, you know, closing ranks and even had angry outbursts against his daughter and his son-in-law, and that there weren't really any priorities in terms of legislative what he wanted to accomplish. And
right.
And so that picture seems to have been confirmed in various other news outlets.
Absolutely. There are things in this book that I would say are simply false. He has a description of it was suggested to President-elect Trump that he named John Boehner to be his chief of staff, and he says, "Who's that?" Well, we know that John Boehner, the former Speaker of the House, has actually played golf numerous times with Donald Trump. We know that Donald Trump knows John Boehner, so this idea that he said, "Who's that?" just doesn't ring true at all. But there is enough in here that rings very true that it's likely to stick.
Mm. And what about the claim that Bannon makes in this book that this is really going to be a money laundering case, Mueller's investigation, that they're going to look at where the money went and that that's where the quote-unquote illegality will be revealed?
Well, he's certainly not the first person to say this. In fact, we were about to talk about the Fusion GPS guys who also said that investigators on Capitol Hill and in Robert Mueller's shop should be looking at Deutsche Bank and why it is that this guy, Donald Trump, is doing business with very shady characters in Russia when other investors and businesses were steering very clear of Russia. So I think this is Steve Bannon repeating things that other people have said, that if Donald Trump is in trouble, it is because Robert Mueller is going to be looking into his business dealings as much or if not more than his Russia connections.
Okay, let's talk about this Fusion GPS op-ed that's in your paper today. These are the guys behind the Steele dossier. So they, Fusion GPS, they hired a British intel officer, Christopher Steele, to look into possible Trump-Russia collusion. And in the op-ed, they say they were shocked by what Steele found. They have testified on Capitol Hill. Why are they writing this op-ed, and what do they want?
Well, they have become kind of the whipping boys of for Republicans who are looking for ways to and basically to, for talking points to get this whole Russia thing away from President Trump. And Fusion GPS, I know these guys. They were actually almost virtually all of them who work at Fusion were reporters, investigative reporters at the Wall Street Journal when I was at the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. A lot of them all decided to kind of go off on their own and start this investigative unit. They are not partisans at all. They are certainly for hire, and that was the whole point of Fusion GPS, that it was going to be kind of an investigative journalistic outfit for hire. The Republicans who on the House and Senate Intelligence Committees and the Senate Judiciary Committee have kind of latched on to Fusion and its role in producing the Steele dossier as a way of saying, hey, this is not all in the up and up, because the Fusion GPS guys were being paid at one point, not the whole time, but at one point by the Clinton campaign or Clinton supporters, and that makes all of the information that came out of Chris Steele suspect and possibly partisan.
And they're saying that's not true, and if the Republicans would just release the transcripts, everyone could see for themselves.
Yes, the Fusion GPS guys are saying, in fact, we are serious, we are investigators, we are not partisans, and if we have spoken now with the Senate Judiciary Committee and the House Intelligence Committee, they have our record. It speaks for itself. If you will just release the transcripts, then everyone will see that we are, in fact, on the level and not political partisans engaging in a witch hunt here.
And they believe that given the evidence, there was some form of collusion?
They certainly believe that the evidence points that way. And as they said in the op-ed that was in the New York Times today, Chris Steele, who was a former British intelligence officer, he got so disturbed by what he was finding with President Trump and, well, then candidate Trump and his connections to Russia and his campaign's connections to Russia, that he himself reported it to the FBI and said, we think there's a crime in progress here.
Hmm. All right. Jonathan Weissman, Deputy Washington Editor for The New York Times. Always great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, why it takes longer to get an organ transplant if you live in L.A. than if you live in a smaller city. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'm guessing you don't think a lot about organ transplants. Maybe you check the box on your driver's license and that was the end of it. Well, here's something you may not know. If you live in LA or San Francisco or New York and you get sick and need a new liver or a new lung, you will probably have to wait longer and get a lot sicker than if you live in, say, South Carolina or Louisiana. You may even run out of time before the organ you need becomes available. And that's because organs are generally donated locally. So even if there are sicker patients who have waited longer somewhere else, a local recipient will get the organ. But that may be changing after a lawsuit filed by the family of Miriam Holman, a patient on life support waiting for a new lung in New York. Alan Zarembo has written the story for the LA Times, and he joins me now. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, tell us more about Miriam Holman. What's her situation?
Well, she's 21. She's on life support. She's been on life support since early October in New York, and she needs a lung. She has a high blood pressure of the arteries in her lungs, and the disease she has is very rare. It killed her sister about 13 years ago.
And so she can't get a lung because she lives in New York, basically?
Well, she's got a few problems. She has a rare blood type, but the bigger issue is that, as you said, as you explained very well in the intro, the organ donation system has a local first policy. Basically, the country is divided into 58 different zones, and generally the organs collected in those zones are offered first to the patients in those zones. Now, her lawsuit opens up some more options for her, and her surgeons think it's pretty imminent that she'll get an organ. And it's in her case now, because of the new policy, that organ could come from a slightly wider area than it would have before.
Well, how did this whole process, this 58 zone process, how did that first get started?
Well, it goes back to the early days of the national transplant system, which is the 1980s, and you had these pioneering hospitals that sort of cultivated their own systems for getting organs. And every hospital that had a transplant program needed an organ supply. And so the system, you know, this is not the system that you would create if you were going to design it from scratch today, but it's sort of the system that grew up over time. And, you know, doctors have an oath to take care of the patients in front of them. And so they fight to keep their, you know, they've been fighting to keep their local organ supplies when those organ supplies are, you know, relatively, you know, no one has too many organs, but some places are better than others. Mm-hmm. And if you're in one of those places, you know, you fight the needier places raiding your organ supply.
Well, why is it that smaller places you are less likely to wait? Are there just fewer competitors for organs or more organs available?
Well, each of these 58 zones essentially has its own equation of supply and demand. And so you have factors on both sides of that affect how long you're going to wait and how sick you're going to have to get before you get an organ, before you rise to the top of the list. So, you know, it could be things like accident rates. Some states don't have a helmet law for motorcycles. And so when those people crash and die, maybe that's at a higher rate than somewhere else. And then you have cities that have all kinds of maybe higher disease rates, higher rates of hepatitis. San Francisco puts more people on its waiting list for livers than any other city or any other major city in the country.
Why is that?
Hepatitis and alcoholism. And they're also drawing patients from different parts of California or, you know, the surrounding parts of the Bay Area.
Well, let's say you do need an organ transplant. Can you just move to one of these smaller places and get one when you're there?
Absolutely. And there are, you know, patients who have means can do that. In fact, several years ago, Steve Jobs needed an organ. He needed a liver. And, you know, there's nothing to stop you from signing up at several transplant centers. And that's what he did. He just had to assure them that he could get there quickly if an organ became available, and he wound up getting his liver in Tennessee, flying from California. It's an odd workaround solution to the problem. I mean, you have patients moving instead of organs moving, and we certainly have the technology to move organs much greater distances than they move today.
So why not just have one national list and the organs go to the next person on that list, wherever they are?
Logistically, that would be pretty hard. You would have planes crisscrossing the country.
Anyway with Amazon. I mean,
that's true. Maybe drones could start delivering them. But seriously, there have been proposals that divide the country up differently, not in these 58 zones, but, for example, there's a mathematician who has looked at the system, and she came up with a plan that would divide the country into 8 different zones. And by her calculations, that would equalize the waiting times for organs in those, or for livers anyway. Her plan was about livers in those, you know, across the country. Roughly everyone would wait about the same amount of time.
All right. Well, thanks, Alan.
Yeah, thank you very much.
My pleasure. That's Alan Zarembo. He's at the LA Times, where you can read his article on organ transplants. Coming up, we'll find out who the winner is this weekend when the Golden Globe Awards air on Sunday. The current leader of the pack, Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. It's like that movie Creature from the Black Lagoon, but with a romantic twist.
To Guillermo, it was the most beautiful romantic thing he had ever seen. He fell in love with Julie Adams. He fell in love with the creature all at the same time. And he thought to himself, as a six-year-old boy not knowing any better, I hope they get together.
How The Shape of Water was made, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In the movie The Shape of Water, a mute woman, played by Sally Hawkins, falls in love with a mysterious human-like amphibian, a creature being studied in the government lab where she's a janitor. In this clip, she tells her friend, played by Richard Jenkins, about her love for this creature, and he's reading her sign language out loud.
When he looks at me, the way he looks at me, he doesn't know what I lack. Or how I am incomplete.
Eliza and the creature are a perfect match, for a Guillermo del Toro fantasy anyway. And the critics have largely bought it. The Shape of Water has 7 nominations for this Sunday's Golden Globe Awards. So we thought this is a good occasion to take another listen to my conversation with the film's cinematographer, Dan Laustsen, and the creature, the man in the monster suit, actor Doug Jones. He said he had a number of challenges.
We had to sell the I'm in water part.
Yeah.
But you also had to sell the I'm in love part.
Which is a challenge when you're wearing a fish costume.
And you're not speaking.
And you're not speaking. My character didn't speak a word, and Sally's character was also mute. She spoke in sign language. I will tell you what, the falling in love, not using verbal dialogue, is easier than you might think, because words can be deceiving, words can lie. But a touch and a glance of the eyes and a tilt of the head, that doesn't lie. There's something very pure and very connected about that kind of communication we found.
So you discovered that as you were doing it?
As you discover each other. Now, we had some rehearsal time ahead of it. We had about 3 weeks together before the film started rolling. Because there was a certain scene, I don't want to be a spoiler or anything, but there was a certain scene that required some choreography and some rehearsal for us. So during that 3 weeks of actually working out where our feet were supposed to go for a particular choreographed scene.
This is the dance scene?
Yes.
And you did say choreographed. So.
I did. So I kind of gave, I am hinting. I mean, but during that time, we really did get to know each other very well. Because when you're on breaks or sitting on the middle of a dance floor, with a towel on your face and going, oh, I'm terrified of this. Are you? Yes, I'm terrified too. We shared our secrets and our laughs and tears and we really built a trust for each other.
What were you terrified about?
Oh, we're doing an interspecies love story.
Oh, the sex scene.
I was terrified of that. I'd never done that in a. I played many monsters over the years. This is my 6th movie with Guillermo, and I played creatures in all of them, multiple ones. So I've done 12 creatures for him now. Never have I had carried this kind of a love story that is all consummated all the way. You know,
because you've never been a leading man.
Not in a monster
or
suit.
A
no, that is correct. That is
and
correct.
You guys, that love sequence is just so romantic. You know, when you're touching each other, you're starting to glow a little bit.
Yeah. I
and
love
the
that.
Way we change the light. You know, in the beginning of the movie, everything was green, bluish, in her apartment. Mm-hmm. And when you guys are coming in and falling in love, we're changing the lighting to like more golden tones and more
and
romantic lighting.
She started wearing red bits and after
that was after that.
Yeah.
And the red symbolizing passion.
Yeah, but that was after that sequence.
Yeah, but when she touches me in a sort of a caring, giving sort of way. Once she and her friends Octavia Spencer and Richard Jenkins helped me escape from the
tank,
the government facility where I'm being tested. and she has me in her bathtub at home. We're finally alone with no supervision, and this little hint of love is kind of like, well, now we can actually do something about it. So the first time she touches me on the shoulder, you see lights sort of like ripple throughout my my, you know, through that area, a little blue lights, sort of like an eel almost, yeah, or something.
That was fantastic.
Beautiful tech. Now, and so.
Was that put in later, or was that part of the costume?
I think it was a combo plan.
It was a combo thing. We tried, you know, the guys that built the suit, they built, you know, these UV lights into the suit. So we was lighting that with UV light.
Great. But right. And at the right time, you would tilt that UV light on me, and there was like a luminous paint.
But it didn't work so well. So there was a technique between real light and CG light.
And CG light.
Because it was too complicated to do that on the set, because it was a pretty small movie, you know, so we have to move fast. We couldn't spend too much time and stuff like that, right. So we have to move fast forward.
Yeah.
Because of the financing.
Yeah, exactly.
Keep going.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the lighting and the choice of color, because it's saturated with greens and teals, this movie.
Yeah.
The light, the costumes, everything. And why was that the decision made? Because I've heard, or I've read, that you initially discussed doing this entirely in black and white.
Yeah. First time I heard about this movie was when we shot Crimson Peak with Guillermo del Toro as well, and you too. And he said, you know, I have this story I want to do. It's about a girl that cannot speak, is falling in love with a creature. And I said, all right, that sounds really fantastic. And I want to shoot in black and white. And I said, wow, of course I want to shoot black and white.
For a cinematographer, that's a dream, right?
All cinematographers in the world want to shoot black and white.
Like classic,
Especially a crazy movie.
Yeah.
So we talked about that a little bit, and you know, we couldn't do that. We couldn't find the money. So it went into a color movie, and of course that's amazing, because I think it's a much, much better call. And when Guillermo was starting to make a movie, he's making this color palettes of like guidelines for all the sets. So it's coming from him. Everything in this movie is coming from Guillermo, because he has this movie inside his head for many years, and everybody's helping him around. So her apartment was like a kind of underwater apartment, you know, green, steel blue, teal, and Guillermo didn't want to have any reds in the movie until, you know, the theater, you know, death and love. And the way we was lighting her, for example, was, you know, she should look like a princess all the way, but she looks more and more like a princess as the movie's going on. When she, in the beginning, she looks like, you know, a normal girl, but still very nice. But as the movie's moving around, you know, it's just getting more and more romantic.
And she has more of a glow about her.
She got more glow as well.
You really achieved something beautiful.
And, you know, we shot you as well, you know, very powerful and getting more and more powerful to the movie, you know, more low angle and more dramatic lighting. It was fantastic.
Right, because I was found in the Amazon, and the locals where I was found worshipped me as a god there. That's the backstory. And so the question remains throughout the film, is he? You know, is there any truth to that?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was another challenge Dan had, too. You know.
So how did you create your identity? Because, obviously, your creature doesn't speak. He makes little sounds.
Right.
But he doesn't speak.
Right. So I had to channel two things. One was the creature from the wild. And unlike other characters I've played for Guillermo del Toro before, I've been many creatures before, but he usually gets me to play something refined and gentlemanly, like Abe Sapien from the Hellboy movies or the Fawn from Pan's Labyrinth. Hand gestury and very, very postured and very well spoken. This was not that. This was an animal from the wild, but with that backstory of he was worshipped as a god, and certain fantastical things happen when he's around. Like I put my hand on Richard Jenkins' head, and then the next day he's growing hair.
I'm telling you, my hair. It's my hair. Look at my arm. The wound. It's like it was never there. Look at that. Now, you said that, you know, he was worshipped like a god. Now, is he a god? I don't know if he's a god. I mean, he ate a cat, so I don't know, but I mean, we have to keep him around a while.
Even though I'm being tested at a government facility, I'm being beaten down, I'm dying slowly. So I have to go through an animal who's, you know, on his way out. but I'm made of something more, something different, something mysterious. So that was my inner conflict I had, and falling in love at the same time, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There's a lot,
and
to,
that's a very part.
A lot to play without speaking a word. So we did
big
have
part
to,
of it, isn't it?
Yeah,
falling in love.
It really was. That was the part of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Guillermo has said this movie is a love letter to love and a love letter to cinema. It was shot like a musical, like a classical old film.
Yeah, it was.
And it's like a combination of genres, it feels
and
like.
And then you see the Richard Jenkins character, he's obsessed with old musicals.
Yes, exactly. Right.
And so he's constantly watching them on TV.
Yes, yes.
And this takes place in the early 60s.
62,
yeah.
Huh?
62, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So old is, mm-hmm. what, 20 years previously? The 40s musicals?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I will say that I found it really, just this detail, really poignant, that after she has her love scene with you, mm-hmm. and she goes off to her job, and she's in the bus,
yes.
and she's looking out the window, and it's raining.
Oh.
And
she's drawing her finger on the, and the droplets follow her finger.
Yes.
Beautiful.
On the window, the droplets follow her finger.
Yes.
And that just, the rain seemed so beautiful then.
Some of that rain is computer rain. It's a CG rain.
You're just ruining it for me.
Yeah, but you know, I have to tell the truth. I can lie for you, but I don't. I'm saying some of the rain was, you know. And you know, that's the scene actually we try to light very, very old-fashioned Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, she have a spotlight straight into her face. And you're not doing that anymore. But we just figured out, let's go that way because mm-hmm. she has to look like a million.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, because she's glowing. She's
exactly,
so happy.
And so we did that. You know, we put an old-fashioned Hollywood trick.
Yeah,
a 300 light just above the camera, and just light it into her beautiful eyes.
Why is that an old-fashioned Hollywood trick? Why isn't that done anymore?
Because people did it, you know, for many years, and it was just getting too unrealistic. And you know, everybody was coming into this. We want to make a movie that looks so naturalistic, and you know, we're shooting a movie without any lights and all. You know, you've heard all those stories.
Yeah.
But Guillermo and me wants to go the opposite way. We want to make a really artistic movie. You want to make a movie where you're trying to paint with the light and paint with the colors. So we was trying to tell a story with the light and the camera movements. And I think that's the reason it works so well, I think, because it's not realistic at all.
So, but you're aware of the artificiality.
Oh, yeah, all the time. Of
and
course
you don't care because it's magical.
It's magical. We want to do it as...
It's a fairy tale.
As powerful, fairy tale powerful
yes.
things as possible.
Well, because Guillermo has said that, you know, when you have a creature in a movie, you have to put the creature at the bullseye of your chart, of how you're going to decorate and design that movie. So his production design started with the creature, and he kind of built out from there, as he's described
exactly.
it, with the color palettes and the shapes and the world. If you put that same creature in a Lifetime movie, it's not going to look right at all. It won't fit. It won't even fit. So this fantastical lighting and the color palette and everything kind of grew out from the creature. And so I did look natural. I looked like I belonged, you know, in the movie that I was in.
Yeah.
So that's all due to them.
For sure. And that's the way the movie is opening underwater. You know, he's just telling mm-hmm. something is weird here. It's not like,
yeah.
this is not like they're coming in underwater, coming into an apartment, and then we are coming into
a
weird world.
It's not a documentary.
It's not a documentary at all.
Exactly.
That's
right.
For sure.
It's not a nature documentary.
Yeah. No, it is not.
But so it's also you suspend your disbelief, and it makes the love story seem realistic, that you could believe that this would happen.
As only Guillermo del Toro could pull off, I think, yeah. But Guillermo was so influenced by The Creature from the Black Lagoon. If you ask him where the birth of this story even came from, he'll go back to being 6 years old and watching TV in Mexico on a Sunday afternoon. After church, that's right. Yeah, Sundays were for church and watching movies. They would have a monster movie marathon on all day. And when he saw The Creature from the Black Lagoon for the first time as a six-year-old boy, he was mesmerized. The image that stuck in his head was Julie Adams swimming at the top of the surface of the water in her white bathing suit and the creature swimming under her, unbeknownst to her.
Mm-hmm. That's like Jaws.
A terrifying image for most of us, but to Guillermo, it was the most beautiful romantic thing he had ever seen. He fell in love with Julie Adams. He fell in love with the creature all at the same time. And he thought to himself, as a six-year-old boy, not knowing any better, I hope they get together.
So it's Tsuchin Reich's 45 years to pull it off.
So 46 years later, he's finally righted that wrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
Got them together.
And he did it really well. Together with you guys.
Really,
you know,
well.
It was fantastic.
Yeah. He made it work. He made it work and feasible. You do root for this couple.
No, you don't think it's a creature. You think it's a person. It's not a human being, but, you know, it's just...
But I think that's another del Toro trait, though, is he has a monster on all of his call sheets. And he said that, I will always have a monster on my call sheet. But I think his monsters to him are beloved. He loves his monsters, and the creatures in his movies are not the actual monsters. They're often a person who's getting it wrong. In our case, it was Michael Shannon's character, Strickland, who's the big bad boss.
He's the enemy,
And he has monster-like tendencies way more than I do.
The thing we keep in there is an affront. Do you know what an affront is, Zelda?
Something offensive.
That's right. And I should know, I dragged that filthy thing out of the river muck in South America all the way here. And along the way, we didn't get to like each other much.
So the underdog, the other, is the theme that he really is so good at exploring and telling. And that this movie is all about that. Sally Hawkins playing a mute, and disabilities in the 60s were not looked upon like they are now. Her best friend, Octavia Spencer, is a black woman in the 60s. And her next door neighbor is a gay gentleman who's closeted and can't come out of the closet in that era either. He finds a way to write stories for all of those characters to come out on top and for the underdog to triumph somehow over the authority figure that is getting it wrong that day.
Or the underfish.
The underfish, exactly. Whichever animal, but it's under.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. That's actor Doug Jones and cinematographer Dan Lausen. Their film, The Shape of Water, nominated for 7 Golden Globe Awards, including Best Motion Picture Drama. It's in theaters now.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Italian food is really more often than not the stuff of weeknight dinners. You know, a bag of dried pasta, some canned tomatoes, some fresh herbs, a little Parmesan. There's your dinner. But good Italian food, that's a lot trickier. Luckily, here in LA, we have a lot of new, really good Italian restaurants. Catherine Spires is here to separate the good from the bad among them. She is the host of the podcast Smart Mouth. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Why so many new Italian restaurants these days?
I guess once the ball starts rolling, everyone jumps in. But gosh, I am excited about Italian food in LA for the first time ever. Maybe since when Mozza started, but that was a standalone event.
Right.
All of a sudden, we're seeing excellent Italian food all over. LA's food has always been about like Central American food and East Asian food. We're paying a little bit of attention to Italian right now.
Okay. Well, what are some of the more notable recent openings?
Okay. I think that Rosso Blu downtown near the Arts District is absolutely fantastic. And this is not a cheap meal. Bear in mind that it is a special occasion type of restaurant, at least I think it is. But they're doing a Northern Italian type of food, mostly from Bologna, which is the richer type of Italian food. The chef, Steve Sampson, has always been a big fan of Italian food, and he finally has his own restaurant. And he's doing, it's a full big menu, but the pastas are really the thing to get there. So good. And the salumi plate.
So lots of meat.
There is a lot of meat there. Yes, there's a lot of everything. The space is a lot. It's this huge cavernous space with a gorgeous outdoor patio. They went all out. I hate to be stereotypical, but it's very La Dolce Vita.
Is there a fountain?
Almost. There could be. They should put one in.
Okay, so that's Rosso Blu. And anything in the Southern tradition?
Yeah, I would say that Cosa Buona in Echo Park is more similar to the Southern tradition because it's kind of the red sauce Italian, which comes from Southern Italy, if you go way back far enough. It's like I said, a red sauce joint, but just a little more upscale than that. It's mainly pizza, but they also have an eggplant parmesan that's better than any eggplant parm I've ever had before. They do this cheesecake with Luxardo cherries that I didn't know you could get so excited about cheesecake, and it is a very simple dish, but gosh, they just have perfected it. It's amazing. They also have this appetizer called Eggs Intonato. Now, I didn't know how I felt about this because it's hard-boiled eggs with a tuna sauce. It doesn't sound great.
No.
Tastes amazing. I highly recommend that everybody check it out.
Sounds a little bit like Tuna Helper.
Yeah. Yeah, you are not wrong. I can't deny it.
Hopefully it doesn't taste like that.
Yeah, no, so much better. Okay. Not even in the same category.
All right. Well, what about pasta? Where do you go to get a good bowl of pasta?
So Evan Funky cooks at Felix in Venice. And I'm going to call him like a pasta king of Los Angeles. He does everything properly. And there's a misconception that dry pasta is somehow worse than fresh pasta. That's not true. They're meant to be used with different types of sauces. Now, Funky is using fresh pasta that he makes, but he's pairing the styles of the fresh pasta with the appropriate sauce. So he's working very hard. He's being respectful of the tradition, and people are really flocking to this restaurant. It's won all kinds of awards this year. People love it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. So those are, you know, upscale-ish. Mm-hmm. What's just a real casual place to go to get good Italian food?
Now, if you want to have kind of the New York-style pizza experience,
yep.
Prime Pizza, which has had a location for a few years on Fairfax, has just opened another one in Little Tokyo. And they are doing both the very floppy, big slices of pizza. And they're
the thin crust?
Yeah, the thin crust. They also have what they're calling the Sicilian style, which is that really thick, almost puffy crust with toppings. And I do prefer the thin crust, but they're both really good.
And anything special about the toppings?
I don't know if you call it special, but something you don't see so much on the West Coast is the pepperoni that turns into little cups when it's cooked.
And it holds like a vat of oil.
That's right. People love that. That really brings back a lot of memories for people who grew up on the East Coast.
Burns your tongue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, if you're wanting a more fast casual pasta experience, this new place in Santa Monica just opened. It's called Uovo, which means egg. They ship in all of their pasta from Italy. Now, I'm not sure that I feel comfortable with the environmental implications of that, but the dishes are really good. It's an all-pasta menu that is divided by region. Actually, Felix does that as well. That's a very popular move these days, so that we're getting an education about Italian food as well. Now, Uovo was opened by the guys who own Sugarfish as well. So I have
the sushi place?
The sushi place. Looks like they thought that pasta was the next get-rich scheme. So there might be something to that. L.A. is always the place where trends start.
Maybe. Maybe they'll mash up the two.
That's so gross. Madeline, no.
What? What? You were the one who talked about tuna earlier.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
All right. How come there is no pizza for dessert, like dessert pizza?
I think because the people who are opening Italian restaurants right now are trying to do the whole quote-unquote authentic thing.
What? There's nothing authentic about dessert pizza?
It's authentic to somebody, that's for sure. However, having said that, a woman named Candace Nelson, who is known for her chain of cupcakeries called Sprinkles, so she's basically the person who kicked off the whole cupcake trend that started a few years ago, she has opened a pizza restaurant.
Oh.
She really switched gears there.
Savory pizza.
Savory pizzas, yes. It's called Pizzana, and it's in Brentwood. And she decided that pizza was her next passion. She bought the restaurant, installed a wood-burning oven. She brought in a pizzaiolo from Naples. Can't get much more authentic than that. Although she does make the desserts for the restaurant.
Cupcakes?
Not cupcakes.
Not cupcakes.
Not cupcakes. More Italian stuff.
Okay. Catherine Spires, host of the podcast Smart Mouth. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cristiano Bordallo.
Yes. Well, I have feedback about something other than Italian food.
Yeah.
Organ donation. And hopefully those two things will not
go together. Exactly. No mashup there, hopefully.
It turns out that a lot of KCRW listeners are organ donors.
Really?
Yeah. A typical message I got.
Like on the list, but not actual donors.
Right. Yes. Okay. Not yet. Veronica Reynolds writes, I'm obviously not going to need him, so someone else might as well be helped. NKF says, I donate because my godbrother needed a heart transplant at 13 and was able to live another 15 plus years. Aslam Khan says, I was fortunate to get my kidney from a co-worker when I lived in L.A. Had no idea how lucky I was in terms of what might have happened otherwise. But Mark writes, I recently had to pull the plug on a friend hit by a DUI driver after a few weeks in a coma. He listed organ donor on his ID, but the family and I couldn't bear the thought of saying goodbye and then harvesting organs while he was still alive. It was a horrible decision, times 10. Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
But anyway, the good news is that according to our poll, 84% of our listeners are on the organ donor list. 7% say no, that's too weird. 3% say no for religious reasons. And 6% say never thought about it.
Okay.
There you go.
So you might get an organ from a KCRW listener.
It's certainly possible.
Okay. Yeah. Christian Bordahl, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.